we get things underway by welcoming in our friend, writer Colin Fleming. Good day, Mr. Fleming.
How's it going, Kimball?
Doing very well, thank you. I want to, before we talk Beatles, I want to talk about the baseball piece that you sent out today.
Baseball piece that I sent out today.
On the Red Sox.
Oh, you mean the blog entry?
Yes.
Yes. Yeah, lots of Red Sox in there. But also some Home Run Baker. That's the one you're talking about, right?
Home Run Baker was great. Yeah, I love that. I also love the information about guys who've led the league in categories a ridiculous number of times.
Right. So I think that started as a Twitter post where I had seen that Ty Cobb led the league in, he didn't lead the league. He was in the top 10 in on-base percentage 21 times. So I was wondering, like, what's the most in any of the major North American sports that someone's been in the top 10 in their career? So, like, even guys who were just prodigious home run hitters, for instance, you don't get to 21. Like, that's, I don't know if that's the record, but it would seem like it would have to be, right? I mean, I don't know how you could eclipse that. You couldn't be in the top 10 in batting average for 22 seasons, for instance, but maybe an even more impressive number is Gordie Howe was in the, think about this, he was in the top five in scoring in the NHL for 20 straight years. In its way, I know it's not as, like, splashy, but in its way, that's as impressive as any, like, Wayne Gretzky number. And I'm a huge Gretzky guy, so there's also something about Home Run Baker, and I was curious about guys who had led the league in stolen bases the same year that they had led in home runs, because that's just one of those things that you might think has never happened. Ty Cobb did it too, but you almost had to do it back in that era when 9 home runs
right
were to lead the league. And so, and then of course, I was going to fob them off on you, but I will say it, our Red Sox were in there quite a bit as well, and they're disgracing us, Mr. Kimball. Pretty bad.
What an embarrassment they've been. A part of it is obviously the injuries, but there are some guys who just appear not ready for prime time. You mentioned Jaron Duran, certainly one of those guys who then doubled down with his knucklehead comments to the media.
There are some guys who aren't ready and may never be ready, but there are also guys who have readily attested that they don't belong in the major leagues. There are too many of those guys on that team. And Duran, he's like 25 or 26 years old. He's not just starting out in a way. I think, I'm not sure, he might be older than Devers. Isn't that weird to think of him that way? But that play where it was bad enough to lose it like he did, we're talking about the in the park home run, the grand slam, but to turn and watch, if I had done that in Little League, now my dad wouldn't have taken a belt to me, but we would have had a frosty weekend. Do you know what I mean? Mm. Like, he wouldn't have been, whenever catch dad, like that would have been a question to prompt much storminess in my father as he like, or, Jesus H. Christ. I'm sure that Christ with the middle initial would have been out of his mouth. But then, like, for him to say after the game to the reporters, like, oh, come talk to me when you, like, had to feel the fly ball in twilight. And then he said, oh, I know what I should have done. I should have turned around and, like, take a step or two. Meaning I should have turned around and faked it so I wouldn't have to deal with you guys right now. But the roster construction is so just baffling to me. The if you know from the blog that I am not a huge Jackie Bradley Jr. supporter.
I have gathered that, yes.
Well, last year he had, and I've looked, you know me with the numbers, I've looked hard. Last year he had the worst year an offensive player's had in the history of baseball. I can back that up statistically. People talk about like the Mendoza line. Go look at Mendoza's statistics. He's like Ruthian compared to whatever Jackie Bradley was last year. His OPS plus was like 34. I mean, like, that's just unthinkable. And to bring him back and this Filene's basement approach to big market baseball, I don't mind if they move anyone shy of Devers. The Bogarts thing, you've gotten what you were going to get out of him by far at his best. It's like, just move on at this point. But it's just gross.
But I don't think they'll do that. And I think that for a very cynical reason. I believe in ownership's mind, they don't have to win. They've got four championships in this century. But if they do a little something at the trade deadline, it will placate the fans and make them think that they're trying to at least get a wild card berth. And so I don't think they'll be sellers. I think they'll be buyers, but in a very half-hearted sort of way.
Huh. That'll be interesting to see how that plays out, because I think it's just going to be a fire sale. I think it's going to be sort of like whatever that year was, 2012, and it just, they were in it like to the midpoint, which you wouldn't think now looking back on their final record and the whole Bobby Valentine thing. But they were like within, and it's easier now to get into the playoffs, but Nate Eovaldi is going to have a lot of appeal to some team. I could just see him going, and I think they've made up their mind with Bogart. I hate the Trevor Story era. I mean, of all the guys, like, he just epitomizes to me everything that I don't like about baseball right now, that it's just so boring, and it's hitting 220. I've noticed lately that I've heard more chatter about batting average, because you can say what you want, and like batting average doesn't matter, but if no one has a batting average, the league is just, it's just unwatchable. It's just, there's not enough happening. And Bogart's like, yeah, 2013 was big, and he was a big component in 2018, and he's been so consistent, but he's a punch and Judy hitter now. The power is gone. The defense was never that great to begin with. It's just hard to get excited even. I feel like maybe I'm different this way, but I feel hard to get excited about the last wild card spot. For me, it's just like the Astros and the Yankees, you would just get, as they used to say, creamed by these teams. They are so much better than the Red Sox. I don't need to see them get obliterated in the first round.
Well, I'm with you on a lot of things, and I think I'll be okay. If Bogarts goes, okay. I understand people have an emotional attachment to him, but I think you're right. It appears that he is on the downside. They've gotten their best out of him. And if they let him go with the idea that they can then invest some money in Devers, okay. But boy, if they let both those guys go.
Devers is someone who, if he doesn't get hurt, he's like Cale Makar. If he doesn't get hurt, you already know he's going to the Hall of Fame. Like, he's that good. I mean, anything can happen. We see these guys, Garcia Parra, whoever it might be, where it looks like Mattingly. If things just stay on track for them, there's no way they're going to miss. And we both know so many examples of people who do miss. He is one of the best hitters. I won't say players. He is just one of the three or four or five best hitters in baseball. And he has the potential in any given season, I feel like, to be the best hitter in baseball. And he's not even really in his prime yet. You don't hit your prime for like a couple. This is age 25 season, so you don't even hit your prime till the year after next year. And so I just, that one, Mookie Betts is turning out to be like, was a good move. If you look what he's doing, people just really like Mookie Betts. I think they like him as a person. But he's a 265 hitter now with an OPS of like 825, 830. These are serviceable sort of numbers. Doesn't drive in the runs, scores runs because he's on a powerhouse of a team. But they were right on Betts. Devers, they will not be right on.
We're talking with Colin Fleming here on Downtown. All right, let's get to the Beatles. They're our topic for this afternoon. And let's start by listening to a little bit of this very interesting home demo by John Lennon from the Beatles' song, If I Fell.
Cause I've been in love before, and I found that love was more than just call it hand. If I fell in love with you, would you promise to be true and help me understand? Cause I've been in love before, and I found that love was more than just holding hands. If I give my heart to you,
couple of things I like about that, Colin. One is just it's such a vulnerable voice from Lennon, and it's so interesting since we're used to the harmonies that were such a big part of that song in the version we all know.
Well, yes and no. He's out of tune quite a bit there because he's he's like you in the shower. He's having a wash down sort of late at night singing. And he is also, if you think about the studio version of the song, he sings, it's just him at first before McCartney comes in. And this is a song that I feel people generally misread, because I think you could also make an argument for this being the cruelest song in all of rock and roll music, because it's portrayed as this like loving ballad, and that's really not what is happening at all in the lyric. It's someone who wants to be with someone else and use them and fake love so they can hurt this other person who threw them over. So that's really not a good way to like be towards people. It's not a very loving way, certainly, to treat somebody, and that's not a good motive or agenda to have. But it's difficult to sing this song, especially at the beginning when it is just Lennon before the harmony starts. So if you think of like a Christmas carol such as Oh Holy Night, you know how everything builds to that one note that you have to hit, Oh Night Divine, like that sort of note. The note here, the Beatles version of that note, is on me at the beginning of this song, and help me. And Lennon, and you'll hear it in the different live versions of the song too, and like on the BBC, that's always such a tough note for him to hit. And when he fails to hit it sometimes, which we'll hear later in this like other live version, that it cracks up his partner, Mr. McCartney. But it's one of those Beatles songs that I'd say is among my very favorites, because there's just so much happening that's emotionally complex in the lyric, and it looks like it's maybe not that complex. It's one of those things, like if it was a story, someone would say, oh, on second read, I noticed all these other things I didn't see the first time, and then on third read, it's sort of the Beatles ballad version of that.
Lovely live performance by the Beatles in Vancouver with those very polite Canadians from 1964. It features a number of interesting performances, a terrific version of McCartney doing All My Loving. And it's amazing to listen to this. Amazing they were able to still hit most of those harmonies, given the sheer noise and the poor quality of equipment that they had at that time.
The big gripe with the equipment for them would have been that they couldn't hear themselves. So it wasn't even so much the amplification for being heard. It was more their ability rather than the audience's ability to hear what the hell was going on. So this concert has what Beatles people refer to as the laughing version of If I Fell, where these two guys, Lennon and McCartney, they just cannot get through the thing, and they're cracking up the entire time. It almost reminds me of like Lennon in his school days with his friend Pete Shotton, and they get called into the headmaster's office, and he'd have them stand behind him as he like showed them this like chart of how infamous, how poor their discipline was, and Lennon would like reach down, and he would sort of like tickle a hair, and the headmaster would like swat his hand away, and Chardon was trying not to crack up and failing to do so, then they would get caned all the more. So this is Lennon McCartney not getting caned, but unable to keep it together. And I think something that interests me about the 1964 U.S. shows is there's, in North American shows, there's a certain innocence to them. Not that the Beatles were ever innocent. They were never really innocent as people before they were Beatles, before they even met each other. But it's when they were taken aback that this was happening still. And you get that in the Ed Sullivan appearances. You get it on their first concert in Washington. And it carries over into that summer of 64, because the Sullivan appearances, and for the most part, in the Washington, D.C., that was almost like the northeastern part of the United States. They weren't seeing this country in all of its sprawling openness, which would have been shocking to someone who grew up in suburban Liverpool, like most of them did. So I think there's like a sweetness to a number of these North American shows from 1964 that are largely, that we're not going to encounter come the next year, really, anywhere else.
I thought it was interesting, and it's a measure, I think, of how fast things were happening for them by this point, that John, somewhat tongue-in-cheek, refers to She Loves You as an oldie for them.
I think that's a big point, actually, and it's in one of the Beatles books that I'm working on, this notion of Beatles time. And he would make these jokes, like, it's an older one from last year. Some of you older people might remember it. And that's not so much sarcasm as it is a decent measure of truth. I mean, Beatles time is different than other people time. Colin time is different than other people time. The Beatles were only doing what they did as a professional recognized unit for 7 years. And it's almost like Keats at the end of his life. He knew he was going to die. He sped up. He does everything that he's going to be remembered for the most part, in 1819. Does that happen if he's going to live to be 81? Like, I don't know, but probably not. So the Beatles were on some sort of different clock than other people. And it's not just enough to even know the years with the Beatles if you're really going to know about them. You have to know month by month, sometimes even day by day, or sometimes later that day, because there's just so much happening, especially in this 1963-1964 period. And that's why this is my favorite sort of iteration of the Beatles, the 63-64 Beatles. I think people don't look at them enough because of classic rock radio. You're not going to hear Things We Said Today on it that often. You're going to hear Revolution and the long medley from Abbey Road. Those things are great, but I think it's sort of come at the cost of the reputation of what the Beatles were and the wonder that they encapsulated during this early period. And this is really, for the most part, this is the end of that early period. It's going to go away in large measure with Beatles for Sale come the end of 64.
And another live performance that I thought was very interesting from Atlanta in 1965. First of all, the sound quality of that was terrific.
They liked Atlanta a lot, so I thought this would be a show that would be worth talking about, where people in bands are almost always like gearheads. Like, they're go into like a guitar store, and you just kind of get lost there, wander around for hours. I was that way with used record stores. Like, I wouldn't even notice how much time had passed. I could just, like, the day would be over by the time, like, I realized they were closing up shop. So the sound system in Atlanta was unlike the sound system anywhere else they were playing at the time. So this is one of those rare shows where the Beatles got to, it sounds strange, but they got to enjoy themselves. I mean, there are other ones where they enjoyed themselves. If you listen to the recordings they made, the live recordings in October 1963 in Sweden, they're clearly having a blast, and the audience is having a blast, but it's a more intimate crowd, and it's not a screaming crowd. It's like, let's listen to this. And I think that's funny. Like, they used to scream like at Rolling Stone shows too, but then if you ever see footage of like the Stones at Madison Square Garden in 1969, people are just sitting there listening, and the Beatles never really got to experience that, unless you want to count people standing there listening when they were on the rooftop. Like, everybody was confused and they were incredulous as to what was happening. But this is one of the best shows from 1965. And there still are good ones. The Shea Stadium show, if you release that, that would be one of the all-time best live albums. And there's a show from June 1965 in Paris with the Yardbirds opening. And it's the only time that the Beatles, during their fame years, did an encore. But for sound quality people, the Atlanta show was hard to pass up.
Yeah, a great version of She's a Woman. And clearly they're having fun. And also I wonder how much of it is to amuse themselves. Lennon introduces one of their songs as, and the phrasing's the key, here's one called Can't Buy Me Love.
Yeah, he was he had a hard time introducing anything quote-unquote straight. Like, if you listen to enough studio outtakes, it's a wonder that they were able to get through some of the tracks, because it was rarely like 1, 2, 3, 4. It was things that I can't say right. Now to you on the radio. but not, they were just they were cut-ups. And when they played The Cavern and when they played Listen to the wonderful Star Club tapes. It's all in jokes and shout outs to people, comments on what someone might be wearing. And that's one of the reasons why I love the BBC sessions so much, especially from 63 and somewhat into 64, because it's like the clubhouse, and they've pulled up the rope ladder, but not before you were able to scramble inside, and you get to be there in like pretty decent fidelity, sometimes really great fidelity on those BBC sides. So they're amusing themselves and they're hearing themselves and they're touting their films. You get A Hard Day's Night, you get Help, and Lennon is singing himself ragged at times, which he would often do live, and McCartney is being the consummate professional. And he always was, even when they played like dismal shows, like the next year in Tokyo. You could count on McCartney to show up and to deliver on Blues Yesterday at that time and things of that nature. So, but even then, you can hear them like having to manufacture this mirth, I feel like, to get through what was the grind of this. I mean, it must have been so stressful, arduous, difficult touring at the time anyway, let alone touring when you were as big as they were by then. Because if you think about it, 65, really, I mean, when is the apex of Beatlemania? Like, it's somewhere around there. I think Shea Stadium is kind of like the capper of that. So it would be that same summer.
It's ironic that in those days they were doing at most, what, 30-minute performances, and now nearly 60 years later, McCartney will show up and play for almost 3 hours straight.
True. People have always made so much. It's one of the first things I heard about the Beatles when I was like 14. Was how short the performances were. And maybe it was a strange reaction on my part, but I've always thought, like, how long do you want it to be? I'm not like a huge, necessarily like a length person that way. I mean, the albums themselves were 30 minutes long. So if A Hard Day's Night and With the Beatles and Please Please Me weren't long enough for you, I mean, and that was just also the nature of the time, too.
Right.
Would normally have bands that were on these multi-artist acts, these bills. And so Sam Cooke would come out, but it's not like Sam Cooke was like, now you get 2 hours of the hits. No, you were coming out and you were getting punched hard. But
well,
in a good way.
And you were paying. I think a friend of mine was at the Suffolk Downs show in 66, and the tickets were like $5, if that.
True, right. So they were, I don't know, it's like I was at a show the other night, and it was, the Cult was the main act, and I was just there to see this other group, the Black Rebel Motorcycle Club, and they played for an hour, and then I left. I didn't stick around for the Cult. I just thought, well, that's perfect. I mean, I don't want to sit here necessarily like for two, if you're going to do the type of 2 hour show, you need to be The Who in 1970, and Tommy's part of that, or maybe like Radiohead, but it wasn't in like their, what could be their last tour, like in 2018. I mean, I don't measure things. It's just strange to me when people, and they do often, they measure like in length. And we've spoken about this, your experiences, your involvement, they're measured in quality and substance and all these other things. They're never measured in hours and in minutes, which isn't to say that a plentitude of hours and minutes doesn't have their place. But to me, that was like that set that I mentioned, one of the sets in Sweden in 1963. It's like seven songs. And you could make an argument that it's the best live rock and roll recording ever made. I mean, you really could. It's not even a difficult argument to make. I made it once in print or something pretty close to it, and I've never listened to those seven songs and thought, I would like 30 more.
Finally, let's talk about a piece you wrote about the Beatles, I'm Down. Why is it the overlooked McCartney song you need to get into your life?
I think I'm Down is, it's a pastiche, first of all, but it's one of those songs that ends up being neglected. And it's no great compositional feat. The value of the song is largely in the performance. And that's not always the case with Beatles songs. I mean, sometimes it's both. Like with She Loves You, increasingly I think She Loves You might be the finest song of its decade and the finest song that they ever wrote. Because, again, there's just so much emotional complexity. It's a sort of short story. It's an epistle. It has all these crazy chord changes in it, and the energy of that record is unlike really any energy you'll encounter with almost any other form of art. I'm Down is this pastiche, is on this like kind of rhythm and blues records and volume based records, which you were starting to get around that time with the Animals, them, and the Yardbirds. And so I think McCartney was consciously trying to do something loud, the way he would in a few years after that with Helter Skelter. Helter Skelter was supposed to be some rejoinder to the Who's I Can See for Miles, and they sound nothing like each other. But he was trying to be like this volume merchant. So I think I'm Down, speaking of fun, is that sort of sonic testifier to the fun these guys were having at times in the studio in this era. This is when they were taking over in the studio, and they weren't like on the clock so much as you tended to be at EMI. Everyone else was. EMI was like so fastidious with the engineers wearing like lab coats, which I always thought was funny. Like they were dissecting rats in between like putting another tape canister in. So you have one of the best George Harrison guitar solos, and you have McCartney, and I think this was a big thing in the piece. It pre-shadows the what's going to happen with Hey Jude. The coda of I'm Down is Hey Jude, just shorter. And there's nothing else that prepares you for Hey Jude that the Beatles had done prior to that, when McCartney's just going to vocalize and improvise over the last, whatever it is, 3 or 4 minutes of the song.
And you also point out that McCartney, it doesn't seem all that down, that his approach to it is to, even though he's singing about a tough situation, he's going to be okay. And if you watch him in the live performances too, whether it's the Sullivan Show or others, I think he does more of the young McCartney head bobs in I'm Down than in most other songs.
Oh, yeah, it's definitely like a don't let the door hit you on the ass on the way out, bitch, kind of song. I mean, like, it really is. It's like, I'm down, but not really. This rocks. See ya. It's going to go out and get some strange, Kimball. It's that type of song. So it's, but, I mean, he didn't write it, obviously, but Lennon said that the reason he liked rock and roll was because he thought it was a euphemism, and what it stood for and what it represented was this, what Billie Holiday, when she was a kid, called that thing. And so this is very much the Beatles were not openly naughty yet. Do you see what I'm saying? Like, you could understand a certain naughtiness if you listened to Money. And there was a live version of Money on the BBC where Lennon can't control himself and he swears. No one talks about this, but it's in there and it's like quite vulgar. But they weren't like these sort of naughty guys yet, like the Stones were, with Satisfaction. And the Beatles would get there. I mean, Tomorrow Never Knows would play a part in them getting there. And then Lennon's comments about being more popular than Jesus, and then I'd Love to Turn You On in 1967 with A Day in the Life. But this is kind of like their first openly naughty moment where it's like, hey, they just don't want to hold my daughter's hand. They want to copulate with like her and her friends. So it was, it still wasn't like the full-throated version of that, but it was squirreled away on a B-side. So it just was this song that I feel like a lot of people have never really known, because nowadays people with their interest in the Beatles, it's like from 68, 69, and now with the whole like Get Back thing into 1970 to a degree, but there isn't like a lot of talk about 1965. That's like an oldies territory. And so I don't think people think of this like revolution as an oldie. So like they sort of straddle both those things.
You can read Colin's piece at bestclassicbands.com. All part of his brand new book coming soon called Just Like Them, a piece by piece guide to becoming the ultimate thinking person's Beatles fan. Colin, thank you as always, my friend. We'll check in again next week.
Okay, sounds good.